from 12 noon to 6 p.m. for contactless curbside pickup or delivery to your open vehicle trunk or hatchback. Selection of wines listed at RoxburyWinesAndSpirits.com. Orders by phone or email 607-326-6200. Or Jeff at RoxburyWinesAndSpirits.com. WIOX is supported by the Delaware County Chamber of Commerce, a catalyst for sustainable economic prosperity in the Catskills, fostering cooperation, forging partnerships, promoting tourism, providing legislative advocacy, and building strong community ties throughout the region. More information at 607-746-2281 or DelawareCounty.org. WIOX is supported by the Catskill Recreation Center in Arkville, working to maintain a safe environment for staff and members to help prevent the spread of the COVID-19 virus. The rec center is closed now. Stay tuned for our updates. Rec center members wishing to access their lockers should email Becky at CatskillRecreationCenter.org.
Hi, this is Ray Pucci, host of Catskills Commerce, alternate Friday afternoons at 1 p.m. on WIOX Roxbury, serving the Catskill Mountain region at 91.3 FM, WIOXradio.org, and MTC, Cable Channel 20.
Okay, you're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate. If you like what you hear, you can also get WIOX on any smart device through the FM radio apps. This is From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good, Ryan. How are you?
I'm fine.
It's good.
What have you been up to?
I've been pretty much just grafting apple trees all over this side of Delaware County the last 2 days.
Nice. Spreading the fruit.
That's right. It's been great. There's some Bob Greenhalls have spread further throughout the Catskills.
Yeah, former board member, Catskill Forest Association. Cool. Yep. It's a good apple.
Delicious apple.
Hell yeah. Might be, actually. I don't know what kind of delicious. It's a red apple.
Yeah, it's Cortland-like, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, something.
So what have you been up to?
I took some bark off of a chestnut oak and put it through the chipper and made my tanning liquor, get it ready to, put some deer skins in. Some deer I got last year, make some leather.
Awesome.
Yeah.
When does that start? When do you, take the hides out of the freezer and begin?
I'll probably start this Saturday to defrost them. Takes about 24 hours. And then flesh them. And they won't go into the tanning solution for a good 2 weeks because they got to go into a lime-like solution and all this and that. But, yeah. So another couple weeks they'll go in the tanning solution. But
okay.
I'll start it this weekend to awesome. Answer your question in a more short way.
Does timing matter, or as no. far as this time of year, you can do it anytime?
I just like to do it when it's not going to freeze at night, because the tanning solution shouldn't freeze, I imagine, you know?
Yeah.
There's like 40 gallons of it outside. I don't know. Gotcha. I don't know if adding acid makes it higher freezing point. You know, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe someone out there does, I'm sure.
I'm sure. I don't.
Come on. Chemistry? You're like a chemistry guy, aren't you, or something?
I loved chemistry, but I don't remember what acid does. I know anything dissolved in a solute will lower the freezing point. Mm. I don't know about acid.
Yeah, me neither. I was thinking about that, though, you know? But I don't know. Anyway, I didn't take a chance, so I don't know. Other than that, thinking about mowing the lawn, not yet, but it's coming. The grass is growing like crazy.
A lot of people mowed the last few days. I think Sunday, I think it's going to be a nice day here in the Catskills. Yeah. Everybody will be mowing then, I bet.
If you're the first guy in your road to do it, curse you. No one likes you. just know.
My neighbor mowed, and we were outside, and he was looking at us as he's mowing, and yeah. said to Julia, I said, is this pressuring us to mow now? Do we have to join it?
Absolutely.
We didn't.
Conformity. You better get that lawn mowed to conform.
His lawn looks nicer than ours at the moment.
Yeah. It's really nice and green, though, when you mow it this time of year. One, because we're so used to the browns, and it looks so green, you know?
Yeah, right.
Damn. But anyway, spring flowers are starting to come up. That's cool.
Saw the first trout lily flower today. Nice. I've seen the leaves for a couple weeks, but the flower was the first today.
Saw squirrel corn, which is kind of like Dutchman's breeches.
Cool.
Which means Dutchman's breeches might be out. Those are cool ones.
Yeah, they're oddly shaped.
Yeah, you know, look like the pants of a Dutchman, I guess, from the 1700s, 1600s, I don't know, something like that. In any case, that's not what we're talking about tonight. We're going to talk about what's up with bats with Ball State University's Tim Carter, and let me see if I can get him on. Tim, are you there?
I am here.
All right. Yes, we can hear you. Where are you calling from?
I'm actually calling from Muncie, Indiana.
Indiana, nice. How's it over there?
Spring is just starting to happen here, and things are starting to warm up, which is enjoyable, and so we're just kind of getting fired up.
People mowing the lawns yet there?
Yes, I won't say we. My son has mowed the lawn two or three times already, actually.
Get out of town, two or three times.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're a little ahead of
us. It grows like crazy this time of year.
Yeah. All right. So let me just introduce you real quick. You're the chair of Environment, Geology, and Natural Resources Department at Ball State University, also the director of Field Stations and Environmental Education Center, and professor of biology at Ball State University. Your research focuses on non-game and endangered species and how land management affects these animal populations. And tonight we're going to talk specifically about the Indiana bat, which is very fitting because you're in Indiana.
Yeah.
Or is that not? I don't know. Is that a misnomer?
It's a little bit of a misnomer. It was named after the state, but it's found all the way up to you guys and down into the southeast and even over past us into Iowa. So it covers a large area, but it was named after the state.
So what got you into wildlife management and whatnot?
Well, I grew up in Western Connecticut, and that's where I spent all my informative years. And we were super fortunate that we had a piece of nature conservancy property right outside my back door. And so my playground was 1,600 acres of woods. And so I just became an outdoor kid and just loved being outdoors and loved catching critters, you know, catching frogs in the creek and fish in the creek and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. And so it became pretty obvious to me and my parents early on that I was going to be an outdoor person, that I wanted to do something outdoors with animals. And so I went to college, and by that point we had actually moved out of the Northeast. And so I went to college and found out that there's this thing called wildlife biology that I could major in. And so I started in a wildlife biology area. And actually, I have to give credit to one of my friends in college. We were on a field trip, and I asked him what he was going to do for the weekend. And he said he was going to go home to his hometown, where he lives in the North Georgia mountains, and he was going to go into some old abandoned gold mines and look for bats, because we had learned about bats in class, and he saw them when he was a kid. And I said, wow, that sounds amazing. Can I go with you? And he said, sure. And there's the beginning of my story.
Did you find any gold?
We did not find any gold.
Okay.
But we did find lots of bats, and it was really amazing.
No kidding. Is that Western Connecticut, the Litchfield Hills, or where is that?
So I grew up in Weston, Connecticut. And then when I went to school, I was actually at the University of Georgia down there in Georgia, and my friend, his hometown was Dalton, Georgia, and that is actually the site of the first gold rush in this country before the famous one in California.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I had no idea there was one. I had no idea there was gold in Georgia.
Yeah, North Georgia, there's all kinds of, they're very small, because, you know, this is like 1700, so they're tiny little tunnels. They're nothing like what, you know, you think of today, so.
So I grew up near New Paltz, which is in the Hudson Valley, and we have Rosendale just down the road, and that was where they made cement and some of the biggest mines, you know, synthetically made, but apparently a lot of bats, we were told, live there.
Oh, yeah.
Is that true, or what's the deal there? Have you heard of Rosendale?
I have not heard of Rosendale in particular, but mines, abandoned mines, and even active mines are heavily used by bats because, you know, they just basically replicate natural caves. And in a lot of parts of the country, there aren't caves, and these mines actually kind of act as a substitute, which has actually helped bats a lot.
How do they find a man-made cave like that?
You know, that's an amazing question. How do they find anything like that? Because we'll have I've done a lot of work with abandoned mines, and we'd have mines that we would reopen that had been sealed shut, and we'd reopen them, and bats were in there within like a month and a half. And I think to myself, how do you guys find this stuff? But I guess when your life's job is to find nooks and crannies and little holes, you know what to look for.
Wow.
So let's introduce this bat, the Indiana bat. What is it? Myotis sodalis? How do you say that?
Yeah, Myotis sodalis. That's right.
Okay. Yeah, with some little biology and habitat for this little guy.
Yeah, so Myotis sodalis is a real small bat. They weigh, oh, about 11 grams or so, 10 grams or so, which means nothing to most people. So I'll just say they weigh about as much as 4 pennies. And so pretty small little animal, and they live throughout the eastern United States, but their stronghold certainly is here in the Midwest. And they were first discovered back in the 60s in Indiana in a particular cave called Wyandotte Cave. And they're very similar to another bat that a lot of people have heard of called the little brown bat. They're very difficult to tell apart, actually. And for a long time, they were just thought to be the same species. And then it was in the 60s that somebody finally figured out, hey, wait, these are two different things. And so the Indiana bat was described then at that point in time. And again, it was named after the state of Indiana because that's where it was originally described. But it's found throughout the eastern United States. Like a lot of bats, they spend their winters in caves and mines and underground hibernating, but then they spend their summer times actually out of those caves, and they live out in the forests, and that's where the females will raise their young. They form what we call maternity colonies, where a whole bunch of females will get together. It can be over 100 females will all get together. The Indiana bats are famous for liking bark on dead trees. So as the tree dies and the bark starts to peel away, they get up underneath that bark. They call it exfoliating bark. And they're famous for getting up under there and forming a maternity colony where the females will raise the young, collaboratively, so to speak. And that's where they'll spend their whole summer, is flying around in the woods, feeding, and then going back and nursing their young. And then by the end of the summer, the young are grown up, and everybody migrates back to wherever their cave is or their mine or wherever they're going to hibernate. And they kind of start that whole process all over again.
Tim, why do you think Indiana is? Is there more bats though in the Midwest? Not just Indiana, but why is the habitat maybe more conducive or not? I don't know.
You know, that's a great question. You know, I don't necessarily think that Indiana, the Midwest, is any better necessarily. I just think, you know, there are certain animal species, and you can talk about birds and other everything else, that just have ranges where they're more concentrated in some areas and less in others. And I think the Indiana bat, for whatever reason, kind of focused itself in the Midwest and just kind of expanded out from there. So places like New York and basically the eastern seaboard are kind of on the periphery of the range, and so you just don't have as much density of Indiana bats in those areas as you do in the Midwest, but it's really not a whole lot of difference. Some people suggest the Indiana bat might prefer that prairie forest edge, which of course happens right here in the Midwest, but we see them doing really, really well in completely forested areas too, so I'm not sure how true that is.
You said that the maternity colonies are roosting in a forested habitat. Is there a minimum acreage that they prefer, the size of that forest?
It needs to be, you know, decent size, nothing huge. I mean, I've seen them in chunks of forest that are, you know, 10 acres or something like that. So it doesn't have to be enormous. And actually, it does appear that they like that fragmented habitat where they like edge. So, you know, if you've got a complete huge forest, there is still edge in there where trees have fallen down and streams and things like that. But, you know, those kind of small-scale farm/forested landscapes where you've got little pockets of agriculture amongst a whole bunch of trees, that's like the perfect habitat for these Indiana bats, which is maybe why they like the Midwest, because we have a lot of that. But, you know, you have that kind of habitat throughout the eastern United States.
So what are they eating? What are these guys eating all day?
Yeah, they're bugs. All of our bats here in the United States, or at least the eastern United States, eat insects, and Indiana bats are definitely no different than anybody else. They're smaller bats, so they're going to be eating smaller insects. They'll eat, you know, basically any kind of insect that flies that they can get a hold of, so small beetles, small moths, you know, leafhoppers, and, you know, all those little small things that are flying around in the evening and at night.
And, you know, there's been some claims about how many mosquitoes they can eat in an hour. And what do you think about that? I mean,
well, you know, a lot of times I just keep my mouth shut because if it makes people like bats, I'm just going to go roll with it. But the reality is I always try to, my analogy is this, right? If you had to eat insects for a living, which none of us want to, but if you had to eat insects for a living, would you eat a mosquito? There's nothing there. They're just legs and wings, right? So, no, bats don't eat a ton of mosquitoes. They will eat them as they come across them, but they certainly don't seek out mosquitoes and go after them. They'd much rather have a juicy moth or a juicy beetle or something like that than this, you know, spindly little mosquito. But, you know, they certainly will eat some mosquitoes when they get the opportunity.
I mean, there's been some claims, too, about how much they save farmers. Is it true that they do predate on pests of agriculture?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. When I was in graduate school, I did a food habit study where I got to look at a lot of bat poop, and you can find all the insect pieces in there, and it was a lot of fun. And one of the things that I got to see a lot of was spotted cucumber beetles, which are definitely an agricultural pest. And they definitely will eat a lot of agricultural pests. You know, in the eastern United States, they definitely help. I don't think they're driving anything, but they help. But when you start to get into some of the Midwest, especially into the southern regions, southern central regions of like Texas and some of those areas that have a lot of agriculture, it's estimated that bats are saving those farmers billions of dollars that they otherwise would have to spray in insecticides to keep the pests off their crops. So in some parts of the country, man, that's a really big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is What's Up with Bats with Ball State University's Tim Carter. So before we get to the bad news, which many people might be aware of, what was the historical population, if you know, of Indiana bats?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question and a little bit of a difficult one. Obviously, it's hard to count bats. They don't like to sit still. But in the wintertime, they do sit still, right? They hibernate. And so we have some pretty good numbers, probably better for bats than we have for most other wild animals. You know, we don't know every bat because we didn't find every hibernation site and things like that. But when we were keeping track in the 80s or so, the numbers were not great. There were some times where in the 60s they estimated them to be over 800,000 to maybe a million bats. And then by the 80s, we were down to like 350,000, which sounds like a lot. But like 90% of them hibernated in just a handful of locations, which really made them vulnerable to you know, catastrophic problems. That started to rise, and by the early 2000s, we were thinking things were going great. We were up to like 500 and something thousand, and the numbers were climbing, and they were doing great. And then the bad news hit that you were talking about, and that's white nose syndrome. And that's kind of leveled off, if not declined, what those populations are doing right now.
So do you have an idea what the population stands at now?
Yeah, so the population right now, I've looked at two estimates, and one of them actually creates this year as the lowest ever, so down to like 320,000. Another one has us somewhere in the high 300s. So we kind of lost all the ground that we made over the last 20 years, but we're at least no worse than we were 20 years ago.
Okay. So what is this white nose syndrome?
Yeah, white nose syndrome, so it's a fungus. It's a fungal disease, and it's a fungus that certainly came over from Europe accidentally. New York is the birthplace, if you will, of white nose syndrome, at least in the United States. And so there's a cave up there in near Albany that that was the first site of white nose syndrome. And we believe, I mean, nobody knows for sure, but we believe that somebody came over from Europe on a vacation and decided to go caving and accidentally brought the fungus with them and then introduced it there. And from that cave there in near Albany, it spread basically across the country. And this fungus, what it does is in the wintertime when bats are hibernating, it grows on the bats and starts to infect their tissues, kind of like athlete's foot might infect your foot, and it causes you to itch. You don't really see it so much, but it's there, and it's growing, and it really is bothering you. And that kind of is what happens with these bats. That fungus really bothers the animals, and that forces the animals to arouse out of hibernation, because you have to understand the entire purpose of hibernation is to do nothing and live on those limited fat reserves that you have. So you're in total economy mode, and when this fungus starts to bother you, it forces you to arouse, it forces you to fire up your metabolism, your immune system, and everything else, and fight off that fungal infection, which, as it turns out, bats can do. But the problem is that fungus comes right back, and the bats have to do this over and over and over in the wintertime when they're not supposed to be arousing, and they end up using up all those fat reserves, and then they die of starvation before the springtime comes when there's food available. And so in a way, you could say that white nose doesn't actually kill the bats. They starve to death, but they're starving to death because the white nose is really impacting their ability to hibernate.
So what does a bat's metabolism, when it's healthy, go down to when it's in the hibernaculum or their, you know?
Yeah, so it's a fraction of what it would normally be. So it's probably easiest to describe it in terms that we can all relate to, like heartbeat. And so when a bat is just sitting still in the summertime, just chilling out on a tree, its heart rate is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 beats per minute. So they got a humming little heart rate when they're just sitting around, right? When they start flying around, their heart rate can rise to almost 1,000 beats per minute. So, I mean, they are just absolutely humming along. In the wintertime, when they're in hibernation, that heart rate can drop down to as little as 50 beats per minute. So they are really going into economy mode, and they may only take 3 or 4 breaths an entire minute. So they really are in slow motion mode. It's estimated that they can be operating at about a 98% efficiency. So they're using about 2% to anywhere between 2 and 5% of what they would normally use is what they're living on each day during the winter.
And you're saying the mortality rate is, where is it, 80 to 95%?
Oh my gosh,
I couldn't find the exact number.
This is brutal. It depends on the species. Indiana bats, believe it or not, are actually not getting hit as hard as other species. Indiana bats are somewhere between 70 and 80% mortality rate, which means that 70% of the bats that get this disease will die. That's huge. There are some other species, like northern longhairs and a few others, that they're up in the high 90s. Like 98% of bats that get this disease die. They're just getting wiped off the landscape. Indiana bats are in a little bit better shape, but they're still getting hit pretty hard.
What is the rate of transmittance between bats, though? I mean,
it's huge. You know, you got to understand how bats work as a species. I mean, they definitely don't understand social distancing. You know, these guys, they'll get together in big, huge groups, and you might have a cluster where everybody is shoulder to shoulder, and you can have 3 to maybe even as many as 5,000 bats all shoulder to shoulder. So, I mean, just think of the New York subway station at the most packed it can possibly be, and that's what these bats look like on the ceiling. So, you know, anything that one bat has, everybody else is going to have too, because it's, you know, they're all in constant contact with each other. So unfortunately, you know, it spreads pretty quickly within these hibernation sites. And then the other thing that doesn't help is these bats do move from one site to another quite frequently, especially early in the winter, or late fall, early winter, as they're kind of settling in. One bat may visit a dozen or more different hibernation sites trying to figure out where that bat wants to spend the winter, and in the process is moving that fungus from spot to spot to spot. And we all know how fungus is. I mean, all you need is one little tiny spore, and next thing you know, it's run rampant. So it's pretty bad.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is What's Up with Bats with Ball State University's Tim Carter. So, Tim, I mean, some of these bats are experiencing 95% mortality rates. I mean, that's a lot. And there's also in the news, is there any transmittance between what's going on right now and bats? What's up with that?
Yeah, COVID, right? So it turns out that, well, we don't know exactly what's going on. It's still too early to say anything definitive, but we do know that bats are susceptible to COVID and that they can be infected by the virus. What we don't know is how easily it's transmitted to them. We don't know really what it does to the bats. We don't know if it's lethal, if they're just carriers. We don't understand that. And then we also don't know if bats can turn around and give it back to people or not. And so obviously those are all major concerns that we're trying to sort out, but certainly we know that they do play some role in this. I would argue in the United States we have very little to worry about because, you know, pretty much everybody practices social distancing from bats. I mean, you know, 99% of the public doesn't touch bats or go near bats, so I'm not too worried about any kind of public issues, but it certainly represents a problem for me and other bat biologists who are trying to work with these animals because we do come into contact with them regularly.
And before we move on to a different topic of this, do you think there's any other culprits for this disease besides maybe cavers? Like, is it have anything to do with habitat? I mean, over the last 100 years, looking at this as a forester, our habitat has changed tremendously since 1890. Anything?
Well, you're talking about white nose syndrome, right? I don't know if it's really forest structure. White nose is new to the United States. It came from Asia, went to Europe, and then came over in the early 2000s. And so I'm not sure that habitat has anything to play with it. It's just that it's a novel disease that our bats never experienced before. And so when it came over, it just hit them like a ton of bricks. Yeah. And you know, bats move around. There's just their natural ecology. And so, yeah, you mentioned cavers moving in, and I think cavers brought it over accidentally. And certainly early on, before we understood what was going on, cavers were moving it around because cavers, you know, used to not clean your gear. I wouldn't clean my gear either. It was just going to get dirty again. Now that we know, and once we educated cavers, they were our best ally. I mean, they were phenomenal. And they all clean their gear now between sites if they go caving at multiple sites. And so I have zero concern about cavers with spreading white nose. Now it's all the bats spreading it on their own, and there's very little we can do to stop that.
You mentioned it's a fungus. So in the tree world, you know, a lot of tree funguses are set in and spread by a wet spring or a damp wet summer. Does seasonality like that have anything to do with this syndrome?
No, it doesn't, actually, because it turns out that this fungus is actually kind of wimpy. It's a cryo-loving fungus, so it's a cold-loving fungus. It actually can't survive above 70 degrees, and it doesn't even really do anything above, I think it's something like in the mid-50s. And so if it gets warm, it just dies. And so it's actually not going to get spread in that way. Now, what it does do is it does very well in high 30s, low 40-degree temperatures in a dark, cold, moist environment, so like a cave, and that's where it does really well. And so it does not get spread across the landscape during the summer months out in the forest. It's isolated to these caves, but then it gets on a bat, and when a bat moves to another cave and drops it off, that's how it gets moved around.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is What's Up with Bats with Ball State University's Tim Carter. We're going to take a break, but up next we're going to ask Tim about you know, why we should care about bats and also what things we can do to maybe foster bat populations.
Sometimes late when things are real and share the gift of gab between themselves. Some are quick to take the bait and catch the perfect prize that waits among the shells. But Oz never did give nothing to the Tin Man that he didn't already have. Cause never was a reason for the evening or the Tropic of Sir Galahad. So please believe in me when I say I'm spinning round, 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 round. Smoke glass stained by color, image going down, down.
calls never was a reason for the evening. Oh, the Tropic of Sir Galahad. So please believe in me when I say I'm spinning round, round, round. Nothing to the Tin Man that he didn't already have. And cause never was the reason for the evening or the Tropic of Sir Galahad. So please believe in me. Ooh.
That's Tin Man by America. Nothing to do with the forest, John. Just a song I like. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest, and tonight's topic is What's Up with Bats with Ball State University's Tim Carter. So, Tim, we kind of touched upon it before, but why are bats important? I after reading some articles about bats and their numbers being reduced so much, I figured I wanted to attract some because I have fruit trees nearby. Is that just pie-in-the-sky stuff, or can it help at all?
No, it can help, certainly with some pests. You know, unfortunately right now, there's not a whole lot of bats left on the landscape to attract, but certainly if you've got bats in that area and you've got pests, they can definitely help with that. There's no doubt about that.
I mean, I see a few at night. Do I know what they are? No.
No. So the one thing that we didn't get into is who's affected by white nose. And so there really are kind of two basic types of bats in the United States, cave bats and tree bats. And a cave bat is what we've been describing, and the Indiana bat's a good example. These are animals that spend some or maybe even all of their life in a cave and then spend other part of their life cycle out in the forest like Indiana bats do. And then you have tree bats, and tree bats never go underground ever. And so examples of that would be like the red bat or the hoary bat. And these bats are migratory, so they spend their winters down south, and so they kind of act more like a bird. And they just hang in trees and sleep on branches, you know, all summer long and even in the winter when they're down south. And those bats are not affected by white nose because they don't go underground, which is where the white nose is found. And so often what you guys will be seeing flying around are red bats, and they're doing just fine other than the fact that they're kind of getting hit by wind farms. They're doing just fine with regards to white nose. So you still have a lot of red bats on the landscape. So if you've got trees in your property, especially larger mature trees, you definitely are going to have red bats.
Do you think their populations are doing better because these other bats are declining?
They were doing better, but it's almost a whole other discussion topic. Wind farms have really taken a toll on some of the tree bats, on the migratory bats, because as they migrate, they move through wind farms and get hammered. And so their populations are actually declining a little bit as well because of that. But otherwise, yeah, they seem to be doing a little bit better.
No kidding. Yeah, we don't have any wind around us here, but there's some down south, right, or something? I don't know.
Yeah, there's all throughout the eastern seaboard, there's wind farms, and these bats are migrating north and south. So they're flying right through there, and they're getting hit pretty hard.
Huh. So let's talk about the bat cave and what you guys do down there. What do you do when you go assess stuff?
So I've done a couple different things. So for about 7 years, 8 years, I guess, I worked on trying to find a treatment for white nose syndrome. So I spent a lot of time underground in caves. And then also I still to this day do research with the bats, and that's just monitoring those populations. We talked earlier about how many there are. I'm one of those many people that go underground and count all the bats that are in these particular caves. And so we'll go in, we'll count the bats. These days we're also taking samples where we're swabbing the animals to see if we can just figure out if they've got white nose or not. Sometimes we're taking genetic samples, some hair samples for mercury testing or something else. So we can take any number of different samples.
Oh, so you're not claustrophobic is what you're saying?
Actually, I am a little claustrophobic, which is why I focus mostly on mines, which are made by humans for humans to be in, and they're big. Going in natural caves are a less desirable location for myself.
Huh. What's it like down there?
Huge. One of the caves that I, one of the mines that I go into, it was mined with front-end loaders and dump trucks. So when you're in there, you feel like you're walking around in a mall. It's just got no lights on. So it's enormous, very, very dark, obviously, and very quiet.
Yeah, I bet. And yeah. Kind of warm, right? What, 50s, 40s? I don't know.
It depends on the cave, and it depends on the location of the cave. Caves are not as constant as people think they are. In this particular one that I do a lot of work in, the entrance is actually kind of cold. It's usually actually near freezing, but then when you get into the back, it'll be in the high 30s to low 40s. Indiana bats really seem to like 38 degrees seems to be their like magic number, but they'll do anything up to or low 40s, and so that's usually the temperatures in these places.
John,
it's pretty neat. What's the soil like down there? I mean, or the rock? I don't even know. I'm trying to picture myself in a cave.
Yeah, well, it depends on what kind of mine you're in, right? Mine, so I'm doing mines mostly. Caves, obviously, it's more natural, and it's what you might expect. But in the mines, it depends what kind, right? If you're in a limestone mine, then everything's limestone. One of the ones that I actually do a lot of work in is called microcrystalline silica, and I affectionately call it cheap white dirt. And everybody actually knows what this stuff is. You just didn't realize it. Pool cue chalk. And so pool cue chalk is microcrystalline silica. It's like one of the number one uses for it. Of course, we dye it blue so that you can use it for your pool cue. But that consistency, almost a talc powder consistency, that's what the material is in the mine that I do a lot of work in. So the walls are all jet white. The floors are white. Everything's kind of a little bit dusty and powdery, and that's what it's like in there.
So you're getting covered.
I try not to, yeah, if you get down on the ground at all, you will get covered. But I just walk around because, again, the ceilings are 20 feet tall and the walls are about 30, 40 feet apart. So it's a pretty big place.
So what do you got to wear for protective equipment?
So, yeah, that has changed so much over the years. When I first started in the 90s, I would just simply go in jeans and a sweatshirt and a flashlight, and that was it. And then as I became smarter, I started using things like hard hats and then got better lights. And then, of course, white nose hit. And so now we have to do quite a lot of PPE, personal protective equipment. And so I wear Tyvek suits, so kind of like those white hazmat-y looking suits. I wear one of those, wear rubber boots so that I can clean those off. We wear latex gloves, and then, of course, we have our hard helmet, and flashlights, headlamps, and stuff like that. And so that's how we go in. And then when we come out, we have to clean ourselves or decontaminate ourselves to make sure that we don't bring that fungus with us and possibly take it somewhere else. So the Tyvek suit obviously comes off. That's a protective layer. And then everything gets sprayed down with alcohol is right now the best thing that we have for cleaning. So we get sprayed the helmets down with alcohol. We spray down our boots with alcohol. And then often we'll spray, because it's alcohol, it's not that bad, we'll spray our hands. I'll probably use alcohol wipe to wipe down my face and my hair and things like that to try to make sure that if I have a fungus on me, that I'm killing it. So there's a lot of, and any gear that we bring in with us has to be either sprayed down or wiped down with alcohol to make sure that you've cleaned it all.
That's pretty neat. No, I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So what have you found that surprised you down there the most?
For me over here in the mine that I do work in, the thing that surprises me the most is how well Indiana bats are doing. So our population is one of only a couple in the entire United States that's continuing to grow. All the others, because of white nose, is declining. And I think I have a hypothesis, that microcrystalline silica, you guys all know it's that pool cue chalk, is really dry. It's really dusty. And I think that the fungus can't do well in that environment. I think it's just too dry and dusty. And so I don't think the fungus is doing really well in this particular mine. And so as a result, the bats are doing just fine. And so that is, I think, one of the keys. We haven't really studied it. It's kind of hard to really suss it out too much. But that's certainly something that we kind of think is going on in our particular site. So that's been really exciting. The other thing that's funny is you know, walking around and you get to see these big clusters, and every now and then you find some bats on the floor because you realize that they fell off the ceiling. So everybody, you know, thinks that these animals are so, you know, well adapted to what they're doing, but they make mistakes as well, and sometimes they fall off the ceiling and have to crawl back up the wall and things like that. So sometimes that's kind of humorous.
Right. Yeah, sure. So
we don't think of animals making mistakes, right? But they make mistakes, they trip, and they fall just like we do sometimes.
Sure. I read a study once about the prevalence of porcupines falling out of trees.
It's like when you know, we laugh when we watch humans fall, and we shouldn't sometimes. I remember going eastbound on 28 coming from Bel Air Mountain, and a black bear, he was way ahead of me. For some reason, he was running full tilt. He didn't clear the guide rail, and just did a whole bowling thing down the. He was fine, you know.
Yeah,
but I was like, all right, that was kind of funny.
Yeah, they're not quite as graceful as we think they're going to be sometimes.
It's great. He didn't even need to run; he could just walk. But anyway, I don't know. So I was reading some of the stuff you were saying, and you were quoted as saying it might take 1,000 years for these bats to come back.
Yeah. So this is the other thing that's really neat about bats that I've always found amazing is, you know, a lot of people think, you say bats and they say, oh, they're mice with wings. And it turns out that bats are so far away from mice. They're so different. And really it comes down to reproduction. So we all know that you got a male mouse and a female mouse. You let them go together, and in no time at all, you have lots of mice, right? I mean, they can make 6 to 8 babies every month, basically. And then, of course, those young can start to breed after a month. So, you know, exponential growth, we all know how that works. Bats have one offspring once a year. So these guys reproduce super slowly.
Jeez.
And so when you have 98% mortality, or even in the case of the Indiana bat, you're having 70 or 80% mortality, it's going to take a long time for those numbers to rebound. And so there was a study that was done a while ago that estimated, and this was a while ago, I don't know if it still holds true necessarily, but that said for every year that white nose kills bats, it will take 100 years to make up for it and for them to bounce back. And so here we are. White nose started in 2006. We'll just make it an even round 15 years ago. And if I could wave a magic wand right now and just eliminate white nose syndrome, it would take about 1,500 years for bats to get back to where they were back in 2005, 2006.
Now, when did studies begin on bats in a big way?
We really started studying bats they've always been studied, you know, all the way back into the early 1900s, but we really started studying them hardcore in the 80s and then into the 90s, and that's kind of when I got started. And that was because of technology. We managed to make radio transmitters small enough that we could put them on a bat. And most people are familiar with radio transmitters. You think of them as a radio collar, so that big collar they stick on the deer or they stick on that bear, right? And then you see the biologist out there with that antenna over his head, and he's turning it around listening for beeps. Well, they made those transmitters so small now that we could glue them onto the back of a bat and track that bat or follow that bat for like a week or maybe 2 weeks. And that has changed the game for us because now we can go out there. Because you can imagine following a bat, it's an animal that can fly 20 miles an hour in the pitch black. It's really hard to follow and to study those kinds of animals. And now we can. Now we can follow them using those radio signals.
You know, the reason why I'm asking is I just wonder, and I don't really believe this, but I like to ask questions, if this has happened before maybe. I mean, obviously the white nose is from Europe.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've been trading with Europeans since the 1600s and whatnot. I don't know. I mean, who knows? The tree roots, for example, in the ground are just mysterious things. We know a little bit about them, but
yeah,
not much. And bats in caves is like, damn, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I agree completely. I'm sure they've had their fair share of hurdles over the years. This one, I think, is fairly unprecedented, as best we can tell from, you know, fossil records and all that other kind of stuff. This is taking a pretty big toll. The thing that I think we can do is look at Europe and see how their bat community is different than how ours is. And basically, if you go to Europe, they just do not have the density of bats or the diversity of bats that we have in the United States. I was over there. I've got actually many relatives that live over there in England and other places, and I talked to them, and they're like, oh, we're so excited. We have a whole colony of bats. And I said, oh, great. How many bats? We have 6 bats, sometimes 7. And I just laugh. I'm like, well, that's nothing. I, you know, we have the bats that I'm working at in here in Indiana. We've got a cave that has it just registered 70,000 Indiana bats. And so, you know, those kinds of numbers just don't seem to exist in Europe anymore. And so we think that Europe went through this massive decline a long time ago. There's actually some Bible verses, you know, you guys know, all know that Bible sometimes seems to reflect the history of things. There's Bible verses that talk about when bats would fall from the sky, which is very reminiscent of how white nose is impacting our bats here in the United States. And so, you know, it's possible that Europe went through this massive bat decline 500 plus years ago. And what we see today in Europe is what we might start seeing in North America here over the next couple decades, which is very few bats and much lower diversity and much lower densities.
Yeah, we've had Mr. Mann on our show before. He wrote 1491 and 1493, and I think he would say that's the Columbian Exchange, you know, bringing back humans are bringing back North America to Europe, and maybe we're going through that with bats too, like all these tree diseases. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. And the tree diseases, you could talk about the parallels here with all those, well, Dutch elm disease, and then there's the emerald ash borers. You know, it's just knocked out all the ashes. We now have this oak wilt and all these other things. And, you know, the forest diversity is similarly just seems to be decreasing dramatically, right?
Yeah, interesting. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is What's Up with Bats with Ball State University's Tim Carter over in Indiana. So let's talk about bats, trees, and forests.
Yeah.
You know, is there any particular tree species that John and I can target membership for? You know, is there anything we should be doing out there in the woods?
So there's definitely a connection where people talk about shagbark hickories and Indiana bats because of the way that the bark peels away and they can get underneath that. I'm not sure I buy into that too much. I think shagbarks are wonderful trees. I love my hickories, but I don't think that they're necessarily that much better than any other tree. Really, when it comes to bats and forests and forest management, what you're wanting is you want a healthy, mature forest. Because what these bats are really after is two things. They're after roosting locations, which almost always are on dead standing trees, so snags. And then they're after, good quality forest, open forest habitat where they can fly around and catch insects. And so you get that by having a nice, healthy, managed forest is really the best way to serve bats.
So this set it and forget it might not be, you know, the ultimate forest. It can also be a well-managed, silviculturally practiced forest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would certainly suggest that a lot of the regulations that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis regarding silviculture and forest management that are tied to bats, in many ways they tie our hands more than they help. And you kind of have to understand where these regulations are coming from. Most regulations are individual or species-specific regulations, and they're not really ecosystem regulations. If we could change the way that we write laws and say you need to protect an ecosystem for bats, we could operate in a much different way. But the way the laws are written is that you shall not hurt an individual Indiana bat. And, of course, if you go in and you cut down a tree because it's for the better of the forest, you might hurt a bat, so therefore we can't do it. Even though the long-term benefits probably far exceed the short-term damage, is what is not allowed under the law, and so therefore we can't allow it, even though we know that the long-term it would be better if we did it.
Yeah, we're running into issues with this. The Ashokan Reservoir, which the city of New York owns because it's inside New York City's watershed, they can't cut during a certain time of year because of the bats, because it's near Rosendale within so many miles.
Exactly, right? And even though everybody would agree, including the people that are regulating you, would agree that a healthy managed forest is in the best effort in the best interest of the bats, they will say that's true, but we can't let you cut during these times because there might be an Indiana bat roosting in one of those trees, and if you hurt it, you've just violated the Endangered Species Act, and we can't do that.
Okay, so what you're saying is Endangered Species Act can't manage for an ecology. It can only manage for a very specific bat.
For species.
Right. Yeah. For species. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's where you know, the law kind of, you know, hampers us in a way. I mean, I'm in the same boat here. I can't go out and touch these animals, even though I'm out there to try to save them and I'm trying to help them. I can't touch these animals unless I have a stack of permits. I have to have permits from every possible agency you can imagine. And unless I have all those permits, I am not allowed to touch one of these animals, even though I'm out there to try to help them and save them. I have to go through all these rules and regulations. And so, you know, there are times when we kind of, you know, tie our own shoes together, right? And this is kind of the repercussions of that, is it really makes things a little bit harder.
Well, someone must be tying it. Because I went to BCI, Bat Conservation International.
Yes.
Yeah, and even on their own website, they weren't totally for the regs. Like, they couldn't really say, you know, that it was habitat that was reducing the numbers. It was more so the syndrome, the white nose syndrome. Is that true, or what do you think?
Yeah. No, our forests are in fantastic shape, right? And again, you got to remember, in the early 2000s, remember, our numbers were rising because we were doing good forest management. We were doing good ecology. We're reducing pollution across the board. We're doing smarter things, less pesticides. I mean, we as a country were making strides, and then white nose hit, and all of our gains were lost. And so I agree. I don't think habitat is what's limiting these species, but it doesn't matter because the law says you may not hurt one of these animals. And if you cut down a tree, you might hurt one of those animals. So therefore, you can't do it. And I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily right, but that's just how the law is actually written.
I wonder, too, if it can have the reverse effect, that it could incentivize landowners to hide bats.
Oh, there's no guessing that. Oh, it's absolutely a well-known fact that if you're a private landowner and you've got mature trees and you think you have Indiana bats, you keep your mouth shut. You do not say anything to anybody, because if anybody finds out that you have Indiana bats, you can't do anything on your property. That's fairly well known, and that happens all the time. Now, I will admit, the Fish and Wildlife is not in the business of going after private landowners, and they generally just leave them alone and don't say anything. But like big timber companies and things like that, oh, they absolutely will keep their mouth quiet, and they don't say anything, and they don't look. If I don't look and I don't know it's there, then I don't have to abide by regulations and things like that. So, that's certainly an artifact of these laws and regulations.
Does it incentivize people to, you know, do the wrong and remove unnecessary habitat? Because I believe there's the regulations state that there's a certain time of year you can cut trees, right?
Yep. And the other thing they'll do is they'll they'll harvest trees. Instead of having it on a longer rotation, they'll have it on a shorter rotation so that the trees don't get as mature, so there's less chance of attracting the animals to that kind of habitat. And so there's all kinds of problems. Now, I will freely admit that the Fish and Wildlife has worked hard to create incentives where we can address those issues. So you can do things like create a habitat conservation plan, which if you work it out with them and you come up with a master plan of how you're going to do good things overall, they can then write you a permit that allows what they call incidental take, which means, you know, you can hurt a couple because we know that the long-term benefits are going to far outweigh the short-term losses. You can do things like a safe harbor agreement, which says, look, my property is not very good property right now for Indiana bats. I want to make it good property, but I don't want you to penalize me for that. And so they say, okay, well, we're going to do a safe harbor, which means we're going to start with a rating right now that you have no animals, and that means that anything that you do that brings animals on the property, we can't hold you accountable for that. That's okay. And so there are certainly routes that you can go through, but of course all of those things are bureaucracy, and there's a lot of people that just don't want to even be bothered with them.
Right. We only got about 4 minutes left, believe it or not. So what do you see the future, Tim? Where do you see this whole thing going?
I don't know. It's hard. You know, I said earlier I spent about 7 years working on a treatment for white nose, and it didn't pan out. You know, I think that's the case with a lot of, you know, drugs and treatments and things like that. It's a dark time for bats right now. I hate to say that and end on a sour note. Between white nose syndrome on the cave bats and wind farms for the tree bats, it's been a really dark decade or so for bats. I'm hoping that they're going to turn it around and that we're going to come up with some treatments here and some fixes. But unfortunately, it's kind of a dark time. But, you know, they're still doing okay, and people like bats. That's the positive note. I'm seeing a lot more, support for bats and these animals. And so hopefully that continues, and we'll do what we can when we can.
What's Oh, go ahead, John.
I was going to say, for our listeners, is there one thing that any landowner might be able to do easily on their property to help?
Well, bat boxes do help for certain species, but only a few, and I never say no to bat boxes, so that's something that you can do. Good land practices is the way to go here. So this is not just for bats, it's for all animals, right? Reduce the amount of pesticides you use, leave habitats a little bit more natural, let some areas grow up in shrubs and brush. That's good for the birds, it's good for the insects, which is good for the bats. Just good land management. Learn about how to manage land in an appropriate way. Sterile is not good. More natural is good. And that's really the best thing that we can do for not just bats, but for all of our animals.
Anywhere to install a bat box? I see people putting them in the sun. I see people putting them in the shade.
Yeah, it's going to vary a little bit depending where you are. You guys are far enough north that certainly sun is going to be a key thing. The best thing you can do is Google bat house guidelines or whatever, and there's about two or three websites that kind of have like top 10 lists that'll tell you the things that you need to do, what color to paint it, how high to put it, how much sun for it to get, what shape should it be. There's guidelines for all of that, and that's easily found through Dr. Google.
Tim, is leaving trees on the ground good or bad, or does it matter?
Leaving trees on the ground definitely doesn't hurt. Doesn't help the bats per se. I mean, standing trees are fantastic for bats, but of course we all know that trees on the ground are good for insects and grubs and things like that that grow in them and eat them, and then of course they become food for bats. So it's never a bad idea to leave trees on the ground.
All right, we got about a minute, John. What do you got?
I just want to thank you for coming on. I mean, this was great. Do you have anything you want to leave us with? And one last final note.
I think bats are amazing creatures, and I'll leave you with a little fun antidote here. If you don't think bats are impressive, I've got a homework assignment for you, and that's to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you're going to go to the bathroom and get a drink of water. But here's the thing. You got to run, and you can't turn on any lights. And we all know how that's going to go. Well, a bat can do that without any problem, flying down the hallway at 15 miles an hour. And so, they're amazing creatures, and I just encourage anybody who's interested to learn a little bit more about them, and hopefully you'll come to love them like I do.
Well, thanks for coming on, Tim. We appreciate the time.
Oh, anytime. I appreciate it. You guys have a great day.
All right, you too.
All right.
If you just missed the show, that was Tim Carter from Ball State University and talking about bats. Pretty cool.
That was a fun show. I learned a lot.
Yeah, I did too. But if you tune in every Wednesday from the forest, 6 to 7 p.m. next week is going to be with Cass Urban Mead to talk about bees.
All right.
Yeah, we're going to talk about wild bees, not honeybees per se, but really about bees in the woods. And apparently there's about 417 bee species in New York State.
Wow, that is news to me.
20,000 worldwide.
Whoa.
So, yeah, she's from Cornell University, and she has her doctorate degree in that, and we'll be talking about that. And that's all I got. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing, and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes, and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd end up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year. Flowers did bloom.
touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town where the river runs down from the forest. Jet soars above the canyon streets, and the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps. And to an old forgotten soldier